much projection to do it.
What does literature sound like? What stories will we hear if we listen to the archive? Welcome to the Spoken Web Podcast, stories about how literature sounds. My name is Hannah McGregor, and each month I'll be bringing you different stories of Canadian literary history and our contemporary responses to it, created by scholars, poets, students, and artists from across Canada. During our summer break between seasons, we wanted to bring you an extra treat from a fellow podcast close to our hearts at Spoken Web, an episode from the Podcast Studies podcast, formerly known as New Oral Cultures podcast. Co-hosts Dario Linares and Laurie Beckstead have come on the Spoken Web podcast to take us back to key moments of their past episodes. You might remember hearing Dario on our last full episode of the Spoken Web podcast. He gave the opening remarks to the Spoken Web panel, Podcasting as a Field of Critical Study. At Spoken Web and on the Podcast Studies podcast, we are all engaged in an exploration of what it means for a podcast to be academic research. By taking us beyond traditional formats of publishing, what new opportunities and challenges do scholarly podcasts offer us? We are delighted to release this special episode of the Podcast Studies podcast and invite you into this exciting conversation. In this episode, Dario and co-host Laurie Beckstead introduce three segments from the recent season that engages with podcasting in relation to media forms and cultural contexts. First up is a segment from an interview with academic Ella Waldman on S-Town as a literary form. We also hear from Dan Meisner on the misunderstood notion of podcast branding. And finally, Galen Beebe from the Bellow Collective website discusses ethics, social justice, and podcasting's media heritage. We hope you enjoy these clips and conversations. Now I'll turn it over to Dario Linares and Laurie Beckstead with the Podcast Studies podcast episode, Podcasting in the Media Milieu.
Thanks very much, Hannah. And also thanks to everyone at Spoken Web for the crossover opportunity that we've got here with the Spoken Web podcast and the Podcast Studies podcast, which of course was formerly New Oral Cultures. I'm Dr. Dario Linares, and I'm an academic from the University of Brighton in the UK. And along with being the host of New Oral Cultures for the last couple of seasons, I co-host and co-produced the Cinematologist podcast, which is a podcast on film and film culture. And I've been writing and recording about podcasting and podcast studies since around 2015. Now, along with the name change and the general rebranding of the Podcast Studies podcast, I'm also going to be joined by a new regular co-host, Professor Laurie Beckstead. And I'm really excited to have Laurie on board and join me for the coming season. So, Laurie, welcome. It's great to have you along.
Thank you so much, Dario. I am super excited to be doing this. I definitely am very interested in podcast studies, and I love nothing more than to talk. So this should be a good gig for me. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your current work in podcasting and podcast research, Laurie.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a professor at in the RTA School of Media at what is now known as X University. Just a little aside there, the university is named after an architect of the public school system here in Canada, but also an architect of the residential school system, which took a lot of thousands and thousands of Indigenous children away from their families to be, quote unquote, re-educated. So we are discussing a name change, and we've decided not to use the name in the meantime. And that's in Toronto, in Canada. So you and I are talking to each other across the big pond. And I teach sound media in general. So I teach radio, I teach podcasting, I teach sound design, I teach media studies, sound theory, that sort of thing. And it's interesting to both research podcasting and to also teach how to do it. and to teach about it as well. So I'm coming at it from a lot of different perspectives. And in particular, my research at the moment is around podcast paratexts. In fact, I just finished writing a draft chapter. I'm feeling pretty good about myself, looking at sort of the ecosystem that surrounds a sound work, like the podcast as a sound work. What is the ecosystem of materials around it, and what are their meanings and relationships? So yeah, that's interesting me at the moment.
Great. And I'm looking forward to reading that, because that is part of a book that we're editing on podcast studies. And I think that the development of that project has coincided with this new rebranding, as I'm calling it, of the Podcast Studies podcast. And we've been talking about that, and I've been thinking about it for a while. And it's kind of come up for various reasons. One of those was that I felt that podcasting has moved on quite substantially since we published the book Podcasting New Oral Cultures and Digital Media with Neil Fox and Richard Berry. And we wanted to reflect that now, I think, within the critical analysis and broader contextualization of podcasting. I think that there is a sort of broader understanding of where podcasting has gone in terms of technology, in terms of being a medium, in terms of being a practice. And those are the kinds of things that I think we want to reflect more of on the Podcast Studies podcast. And it's interesting, I think it fits a little bit with what you were talking about in terms of coming from a sound studies background. So thinking about how might we conceive of podcast studies as a discipline in relationship to things like sound studies and radio studies and sound arts practice. But also thinking about things like audience reception, audience research, podcasting as identity formation and representation, and also podcasting as part of a social and cultural milieu. Also, we had a discussion on how to name podcasts kind of more broadly, didn't we, Laurie?
Yeah. In fact, I came across recently, there's a new AI podcast name generator, which I found kind of fun and silly. So you can copy and paste your description of your podcast in, and it will suggest a bunch of names. But I find that there's a lot of popular wisdom out there around how to name a podcast, and that many folks will tell you, name it so it's exactly clear what you will get when you listen to the podcast. And so, for example, Dan Meisner, who was on the show last season, and we actually have a clip coming up from him, an excerpt from that interview. He is a podcaster, and the name of his podcast is Grownups Read Things They Wrote as Kids. And that's just the ultimate, that's exactly what you're going to get. So I think the Podcast Studies podcast, while, it might seem a little bit on the nose, I think it is exactly what people will get when they tune in.
Yeah, I mean, it's always tricky, isn't it, that there is that, there's that way of thinking, which is, you know, do exactly what it says on the tin. And then there's the sort of, oh, I'm going to be kind of quirky and a bit mm-hmm. weird and a bit off the cuff. And you have to kind of discover what this is about. And I think really with our academic hats on, although, you know, we want to be as accessible as possible, I think, on the upcoming season. I think that having a clear name, that we are interested in this approach to analyzing and being interested in podcasting from that background, I think is paramount.
Right. And also the name, a couple of twits bloviating about podcasting was taken already, right? So
yeah, that's it. So you've got to kind of plump for what is possible, I think. And I think also, you know, there's a lot of podcasts out there that are about podcasting, but in a very different way to the kind of show that we have done and we want to continue to produce. So we're less interested in kind of advice for commercial success, you know, mm-hmm. either in terms of making content that is for a broad audience or in terms of kind of audience building for economic reasons. Indeed, looking at how podcasting has become formalized as an industry and discourses around that area is something that we're aiming to look at critically. But mm-hmm. also, I think there's more areas that I think in the coming season that we want to address, Laurie, that you've been thinking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, podcasting and peer review is something that's on my radar, and I know it's definitely on yours too, Dario. And so I think we'll be exploring that a lot more in the upcoming season. And also, I think the idea of genres and categories for podcasts, while it might on the surface almost seem like a minor thing, I think that's huge. And I think that's really worth pulling the lid off and having a look and stirring things up a little bit, because categories, Apple gives you a list of categories you can pick from as a podcast producer, and many producers say these categories really don't speak to what my podcast is about, and yet that is what you're stuck with. And recommendation engines seem to just kind of really kind of, they seem stalled in this area of, well, if you liked this from this particular category or genre, then here's some others from that same category or genre. And I think that's just a really far too simplistic way to think about what podcasts are and what they do. And we need to start looking at other elements of the podcast, you know, the form, the presentation style. You know, there can be documentary podcasts on a historical subject and say a popular music icon, and they will be in very different categories, but they might be very, very substantively similar and enjoyable to the same audience. So I think looking into those issues too might be interesting.
Yeah, I think that sense of the difference between, or the correlations between content and form, kind of cut across the traditional notions of genre, I think, as you're alluding to there. Mm-hmm. And also, I think what's interesting, and you'll hear this on the clips that we have for you today, and it reflects, I think, how Spoken Web podcast and the Podcast Studies podcast do have a kind of kinship in terms of being interested in the way that there is a connection, or the way that we might look at the relationship between podcasting and, say, literary studies or journalism. Mm-hmm. And I know that's something that is very much of interest to Hannah and Stacey and Catherine and everybody over at Spoken Web, for sure. And we have always and continue to be interested in being a space for academics and other content producers in the area of sound to produce individual episodes or series, and offering a place for them to distribute that without having to set up whole podcast hosting or distribution infrastructures for themselves. And the big example of that in the last season was Jerry Padfield's work on his PhD casting. So he's doing his PhD as a podcast by practice, and we offer him an outlet to do that. So
it's a great series. We
are definitely looking at continuing to do this and hoping that we can further offer a platform for diverse voices and approaches to understanding and utilizing the medium. So if you're interested in publishing some audio work with us, please don't hesitate to get in touch. So we're going to share with you three clips from interviews that we recorded in the last season of New Oral Cultures. Our first clip is from my interview with PhD student Ella Waldman, which was recorded on April the 30th, 2021. And her work focuses on S-Town and the ways in which the podcast Inform and Marketing drew upon the discourses of literary form.
So it was released as a finite product, 7 episodes called Chapters, that were released simultaneously.
That's actually been talked about as being quite important. I mean, Reed's mentioned it himself. And I think I'm right in saying that this is the first podcast that didn't drop one after another in the serial format, you know, because we always make that connection between podcasting and serial. And it seems that overarching distribution technique, or the way of just dropping it all in one go, seems to have been both effective but also intended that way.
Yeah, I found out that it was the first one to do that, the first podcast to do that, and that it was very a very explicit, you could say, a way of branding itself as something akin to a novel. Reed and Snyder, when they were in production, were referred to their production as a nonfiction audio novel, and really had that model in mind. So in its form, in its structure, it's extremely almost too novelistic, and it's very explicitly modeled after a novel. And then in its themes as well, and in the very contents of the podcast, it's completely pervaded with intertextual references, meta-textual references. It's I called it a hyper-literary podcast, because it's almost conspicuously presented as literary. So obviously the critics fell for it. At that time, I'm not sure if
podcast criticism was already as established as it is now. So I guess it's also people who tended to be more of literary critics or film critics who covered the show and who were absolutely seduced by the novelistic nature of the show. And so all of the reviews stated that, used it as an argument for its quality, to praise its quality, to say how good it was.
Do you think that this is a sort of an example of the ways in which the relationship between old and new media always has this kind of, on the one hand, a tension in the fact that the new is replacing the old, so the new is always sort of better and more interesting and doing sort of avant-garde things, even if it might not be. But then also the new always suffers from this idea that it doesn't have the highbrow quality underpinning to it. And do you think that S-Town sort of represents that move, maybe not intentionally by anybody, but, you know, that sort of sense of a medium trying to search for its credentials, or that, you know, this is grounded in this thing that we all recognize as having a long history in terms of storytelling?
Definitely, yeah. When S-Town actually won a Peabody Award, and the award speech said that the podcast was breaking new grounds with its novelistic form and structure, or something like that. And I thought it was interesting that in order to praise how innovative and revolutionary and new this podcast was, they were referring to the more established, you know, standard of the novel, which felt paradoxical,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But then at the same time, if we take it from a different perspective, and of course this is this goes in line with questions of remediation, the fact that new media tend to recuperate older forms and remediate them, refashion them, etc. Nothing absolutely new is ever created, etc. And also at the same time, if we take it from another perspective, if we think of S-Town as a literary object or as a novel, I think it's interesting insofar as it challenges the very definition of what a novel is and what literature is, or what it means to for something to be literary, right? So it's not necessarily, yes, a conservative move here.
And I think also the problem with that, or one way to look at that with a critical eye, that sense of, oh, we're going back to the accepted novelistic structures and depth because that is going to retain or create a real highbrow engagement. But really, in a sense, and this happens a lot now with the way that audio is starting to be conceived of, I think that it's even moving us back to earlier times when the focus of storytelling was on oral traditions. And I'm just wondering, I mean, you talk about this idea of story listening. And in Reed's interviews, he did this interview on the Long Form podcast where he starts to talk a little bit about this idea of having the mindset of a novel when you're listening. I'm just wondering whether you think that S-Town and then maybe the way that podcasts are starting to be produced now is changing the way and the expectation of how we understand what listening is away from radio and back to kind of more novelistic structures, if that's not too convoluted a question.
Well, what it certainly does, what podcasts certainly do, is bring a new scope, I think, to narratives and introduce a new temporality that are closer, yes, to the ones that we're used to with novels. And you're right, it's also a way of pointing to something that's much older and that predates text, which is, of course, oral story. Telling, yes. What's interesting in S-Town is how many storytellers there are in the story. Of course, Brian Reed, host and narrator of the podcast, you could say is the overarching framing voice that you'll hear. But then there's, of course, John B. McLemore, who is a natural storyteller as well. Some called him poetic genius, with really virtuosic, virtuosic use of language, etc. And then there are other characters as well.
Once he got in touch at 1:30 in the morning because a bunch of cops had been in his yard.
And I had the Praetorian class cowering behind that uniform.
It felt as if by sheer force of will, John was opening this portal between us and calling out through it, calling from his world, a world of
proleptic decay and decrepitude.
say, people as well in the podcast who are storytellers, and the reporter, the narrator turns simply into a listener, into someone who receives, records those stories, and of course ultimately shapes them into a coherent narrative. But I think it's really beautiful to have these people, to hear these people, and to be able to hear their voices.
So it's really interesting to listen back to Ella and her discussions on S-Town. And there's another article that's just come out from Siobhan McHugh, which kind of mines the same territory. I don't know if listeners may have come across that. But Laurie, what did you make of that clip in the context of this subject?
Oh, yeah, it's fascinating. And I have to say, S-Town was the first podcast I ever just binged in one
Oh, really?
Go. Yeah, I was so fascinated with that. And it's interesting to hear Ella. She's so articulate and really interesting insights there. But it's interesting to hear her talk about podcasts as literary works and their relationship to the novel. And in this case, absolutely, it felt like S-Town was a lightning strike. Like, it's not going to happen again. And imagine being the producer and getting an email in your inbox inviting him into this man's world, John McLemore, into his amazing, fascinating world and the characters in it. And Ella mentions how great it is to be able to hear their voices in this story. And absolutely, they're incredible voices. But she also touches a little bit on the idea that, you know, whose story is this to tell? It's an extraordinary story. In some ways, it felt so raw emotionally and so completely, like, all of the characters in this story are very vulnerable in a sense to the audience as they, you know, get this bird's eye view into their, or even a zoomed in view into their life. You know, whose story is it to tell? And of course, there was, listeners may know that the producers of S-Town were sued by the estate of John McLemore for allegedly using McLemore's identity for a commercial purpose, which is apparently against a particular law in Alabama, and they settled out of court. So there was something there, and I think that relates to what's coming up in our next excerpt, where you spoke with Galen Beebe, who is a contributing editor at Bellow Collective, and she talks about the ethics of this type of podcast. And Galen, like Ella, has a literary background and first found her way into podcasting as a story editor. So she specializes in structuring stories, which is so important in that style of podcasting, and is also extremely difficult. I find story structure is one of the things that my students who are pursuing this type of nonfiction storytelling, or even fictional storytelling, structuring the story is everything, and it's really difficult. Yeah, so why don't we play that clip now? This is Galen Beebe from Bellow Collective. This was recorded in March of this year, of 2021, and here it is.
I'm particularly interested in criminal and social justice podcasts. I think for a number of reasons. One of them is, I think it's really important work. I think it's really important to be engaging with and to be, you know, helping to get at often big ethical or structural questions in the world that we live in. There's also, you know, a lot of podcasts do deal with crime and do deal with criminal justice in the true crime sense, or in the more reported or documentary sense, or in conversation. And true crime is ethically complicated. You know, I often think it's not ethical. And so I'm not able to enjoy seems like a weird word when you're talking about criminal justice. But, you know, that's a big block in my experience.
Yeah, you have ongoing questions about it.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think often more journalistic or documentary pieces that deal with that same system actually engage those questions, either explicitly or they leave space for me as a listener to engage them without just feeling, oh, you're exploiting the victim, you're exploiting the, yeah, you know, perpetrator. Or
do you think that has come out of some of the criticisms of Serial back in the day, of what the role of Sarah Koenig, sorry, her name escaped me there for a second, but do you know what I mean? That sort of sense of what her position was within the actual investigation, and then subsequently the impact that Serial had. Then suddenly there was a lot of Serial imitators, and then now there's this sort of sense where, well, where are the ethics of social justice in terms of podcasting just being a, you know, a way of kind of exploiting victims or, you know, whoever suffered these crimes?
Yeah, I think that is definitely part of it. And I do think if Serial had been about something else and been as successful, I wonder where we would be in terms of, you know, what stories might have gotten made to try to create the next Serial. I think when I first moved to Boston in 2017 and started actually meeting people in person who wanted to talk about podcasts all the time, very exciting moment for me. That was right when there was a lot of conversation about the role of the journalist, not about Serial. It was, you know, a couple of years later. It was when the Marketplace writer was fired. I don't know if you know, but remember this, for writing a blog post. I can't remember his name, but he wrote a blog post that was that exposed bias.
Right, right.
With big quotes, sure. You know, and so was asked to take it down or leave Marketplace. And so that was kind of the conversation that I like first entered into. And I think we have just been grappling with that conversation in various forms since Serial, before Serial, but more and more as podcasting grows. And it's what I'm very interested in is, what does it mean to be a journalist? What is the role of the journalist? There are people who call themselves journalists who I don't necessarily think of as journalists. And, you know, with the, it's harder to write yourself out of the story when you're speaking the story than when you're writing the story. And so I think kind of all of those different threads and conversations are just tangling together and recurring in different, through different shows. And like, I think the same sort of a question came with S-Town and with Missing Richard Simmons and just with shows that are so captivating, but should they have been made? Should they have been made this way? Whose story is it?
Yeah, it's an interesting space that podcasting operates when it comes to journalism and the idea of the construction of knowledge and the dissemination of knowledge in digital context, because, you know, we're living in this sort of post-truth era, you could argue. And it seems to be accepted now that on the one hand, the era of social media has created this sort of monster of information crisis and how do we know anything about anything. So therefore, on the one hand, we've got these kind of ecosystems and bubbles. And yet, on the kind of other hand of that, on the old legacy media and journalism like television or the New York Times or whatever, they are still kind of wedded to their old school ways of doing it that seem kind of archaic. But yet podcasting seems to somehow fall in the middle. It really requires the digital infrastructure to work, but yet has all these, you know, all these echoes back to radio and professional journalism. So it's a really interesting, and maybe, I don't know if you think it's a unique space that podcasting kind of has to negotiate in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, my sort of theory about podcasting, or one of my theories about podcasting, is it has this dual legacy of radio on the one hand and blogs on the other hand. And each of those ancestors has its own ancestors, you know, of zines or pamphlets, or, you know, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, you know, somebody standing on a soapbox. And then radio has other legacy media that came before it. And then it's also fed into by, you know, I think kind of the commercial radio side of things, or, you know, however you plug in a Spotify or whoever. So I think it is unique, but I think one thing that's unique about it is that podcasting is such a broad concept. You know, I feel like it's as if we were talking about moving image, and everything was there from a TikTok to a YouTube channel to Hollywood, and it's all accessible in the same place. And there are newsletters or, you know, Discover pages where you will have them all right next to each other. And so I always find it funny to go in these Facebook groups and whatnot that are just like we listen to podcasts, you know, or to talk to somebody. I don't think this is quite as true anymore as it's become a bigger medium, a more widely imbibed medium. But I would have these conversations like, oh, you listen to podcasts, I listen to podcasts. And it's sort of like, we both read books or magazines, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, a lot of what you say there really chimes to me in the way that I came to podcasting, because I'm a film background. I teach film at university. And it's always interesting to me to listen now to the debates about radio versus podcasting. And you, in a similar vein, from a literary background, I'm assuming, like, say, for example, you don't see your way into podcasting as coming from radio, as having all the skills of radio and being maybe even being that interested in radio. It's from a different direction. So it's always interesting to me now, and there's still people out there who, especially in the academic fields, who sort of really push this narrative of podcasting is just radio, really kind of repackaged or redefined. I mean, I don't know where you, it would seem you've sort of said there that you'd sit on this sense that podcasting is its own thing.
I think it's definitely its own thing. I mean, again, my perspective on it is very different now than it was a few years ago, but people will come to podcasting from a lot of different mediums or a lot of different backgrounds in a way that I don't know. I'm not terribly well versed in film or TV or, you know, even radio, broadcast radio, but I know so many people who come from a film background or a documentary background or a photo background or, you know, reality TV or all of these different things and come into podcasting bringing all of that with them. Whereas I don't think that's quite as true in other spaces. Mm. And there's community radio. And again, I can't speak that much to that, but there's so much of what is now called user-generated content in podcasting that it's just, there is so much independently created work that I just can't see a parallel with that and radio. Yeah.
Those two clips, I think, really sit together nicely, and it really draws your attention to the difference as a journalist when you're working just with words and when you're working with audio. And I love that quote that Galen gives there, where she says, it's harder to write yourself out of the story when you're speaking the story. It takes me back to work I did back in the day in my PhD, when I was doing a lot of analysis of the new journalism. So writers like Norman Mailer and Tom Wolfe. And that was that first iteration, I think, of journalists who were purposely positioning themselves within the story. And obviously that was just through written text. So it's interesting how podcasting has sort of revitalized that ethical debate or that debate about professional journalism and where you situate yourself within the story. And of course, it was a key question, I think, that came on the back of Serial and has now kind of expanded, I think, if you listen to other professional journalists and their relationship to the audience and the work when they're working with podcasts. And when I spoke to the journalist Steve Richards, he sort of alluded to that on the last series as well, where now thinking about what your position is to the story is just as much a journalist's role as it is, you know, reporting on the factuality of the story or the event itself. And it's interesting how that seems to sync up with a lot of the issues we have these days with our relationship to truth and knowledge and information.
Mm-hmm. And it's so true that by writing a story, I mean, that's one level of remove from the story as opposed to speaking it. And this is, you know, it's been ever thus the idea of how separate is the journalist from the story and can they ever possibly be? I mean, my thinking on that is it's extremely difficult for journalists to be quote unquote objective. I mean, there's no such thing when people are talking to people to get a story, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also it ties in a little bit to some questions that I think as academics we have to have, you know, especially in terms of if academics are going to start using podcasting to disseminate their research, which is obviously something that we're investigating right now. And that idea of being able to articulate your research to a wider audience and make it, not make it entertaining or make or not dumb it down. And in fact, you know, rejecting that idea if you are speaking about your research and you're speaking about it from a personal perspective. So you're relaying information that may be on the one hand objective, but your relationship to it is not objective. You know, that's always just as important or just as interesting, or a way into the work, a way into the subject matter that audiences do tend to connect with. So getting over that idea of removing yourself and just having the objective knowledge there, I think that it's interesting how podcasting leads us to that question.
Yeah, it really can be the opposite of that, where the research, the ideas, the quote unquote science is embodied. It's literally embodied when it's being spoken about in a podcast. It's coming out through a person's voice. Yeah, it's a really fascinating subject. So much to dig into there.
So yeah, let's move on to our third clip. So this is your interview with Dan Meisner, who is somebody who works within the field of branded podcasts. Now, this was a really interesting subject for me because it kind of alerted all my prejudices to the kind of podcast that I want to listen to. So yeah, it was an interesting subject matter to broach with him, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm certainly was very cynical about this idea of what is a branded podcast. Isn't that just an extended infomercial? And why on earth would anyone, you know, with any type of sort of radar want to listen to that? But Dan is he's a very smart guy. I've worked with him for a very long time. He was a broadcaster. He's been the broadcaster in residence in our department for the last couple of years. Way back, he was a student of mine.
Oh, wow.
But I learned a lot more from him than he did from me, I'm sure. But yeah, so he's got some fascinating insight into this. He's the head of audience development at Pacific Content. So Pacific Content is a company here in Canada that does branded podcasts. They've worked with lots of huge major brands. And so let's find out what they are and why anyone would want to listen to them. Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about your day job as head of audience development at Pacific Content. And Pacific Content does branded podcasts. What exactly is a branded podcast?
I think it depends on who you ask. We take a pretty big and broad definition of branded podcast. Essentially, any audio podcast that involves a brand in its production and editorial. And, you know, the financing of the show. So unlike a lot of podcasts out there that are passion projects and made by independents or big network shows that are supported by an ad-based model, or some of the shows out there that are supported through direct patronage or live event sales, there's lots of different business models. But the branded podcast work that we do is different in that every single show that we make is underwritten, funded by, and produced and published by brands. So we work with some pretty big companies like the Ford Motor Company, Dell Technologies. We've done work with Facebook. We work with Adobe. We work with some financial services companies like Morgan Stanley and Charles Schwab. So we sort of tend to think about branded podcasts or original podcasts with brands as shows that are genuinely audience-first series, not infomercials, not thinly veiled advertising, but just happen to be produced by brands.
So in other words, you're out to make an amazing, enjoyable podcast that will attract listeners because it's really fascinating to listen to, but it just happens to be, yeah, like you said, I mean, there's a little bit of suspicion, like, is this going to be an infomercial? Will they be trying to sell me, financial ETFs and things like that?
Yeah, and I think there's absolutely a smell test that anything from a brand needs to pass. Initially, people might be cautious about a show that comes to you from a brand. But when you do it right, when you actually make a show that is worth somebody's time and attention, when you offer them something that is valuable, it's often a pleasant surprise to find out that it came from a brand.
So give us some examples of the types of stories that are being told through these podcasts and for which company, like how that relates to each other.
So we work with Charles Schwab, pretty large American financial services company. And when we started working with Schwab, we made a pretty important decision to make a show that was not at all about the products that they offer, the services that they offer. Instead, we decided to work with Schwab to make a show about decision-making. So we make a show called Choiceology, which is hosted by Katie Milkman. She's a Wharton prof. She's a behavioral economist. She is sort of at the forefront of decision science. And the show Choiceology is all about sort of the behavioral economics and some cognitive biases and traps that we can sometimes fall into. So it's explicitly not about your finances. There's no mention of products or services. Nobody's trying to sell you anything. It's just a really well done, highly researched show about avoiding mistakes in decision making of all kinds, financial and otherwise. And so from the listener's perspective, if you're the kind of person who enjoys Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, or if you enjoy Freakonomics, or if you enjoy sort of the brain science behind the decisions that we make as human beings, it's just a great show that will hopefully turn you on to some ways that you could make better decisions. Oh, and there's storytelling, and they interview people within this field of behavioral economics. And from Schwab's perspective, even though they are not directly selling financial services and products, it positions them as a company that is interested in helping people make better decisions, right? So there's a benefit for the brand in terms of Schwab sort of being seen as a trusted partner and a trusted voice and an authority in sort of smart decision making. There's a benefit for the listener in that they get to listen to a really great show with lots of fun stories and you learn something. And that's the kind of win-win. And it's a balance, right? It can be a tricky thing to sort of strike the right balance of what a brand wants to say and what listeners want to hear. But when you do it right, you can make really, really great shows that sort of serve everybody.
Interesting. And so you are the executive in charge of audience development. What is audience development? What does that entail?
Audience development means lots and lots of different things, depending on who you ask. I take a pretty broad definition of audience development. And so that stretches through the entire project. When we talk about audience development in terms of show design, it starts on day one, right? It's figuring out who is the show for. Who are we trying to serve? Who are we trying to reach? What is the show that we're trying to make? What is the show that only we could make, right? So audience development is in part about helping our clients design shows that can reach and will reach audiences. A lot of it is understanding the existing landscape, right? Doing a fair amount of research. What's already out there? Right. If you're making a show designed to appeal to automotive enthusiasts or designed to appeal to people who care about the history of manufacturing in America, it's good to understand what's already out there and how those audiences are already being served. So there's an audience development angle to show design and sort of initial show strategy. I think there is absolutely an angle of audience development that flows through the creation of individual episodes week after week after week after week, you know, building campaigns to market and promote your show. And then audience development for me also includes measuring, reporting on and learning from the performance of your show, right? So I think about that from a marketing perspective, you know, which of our marketing efforts actually yielded new listeners, which of our marketing efforts yielded new downloads to the show. But I also think about measuring the editorial quality of podcasts. And one of the great things that I've seen just over the past couple of years is how useful editorial information is now being supplied by some of the podcast apps themselves, right? So being able to go into Apple Podcasts Connect, or being able to log into Spotify for Podcasters, or similar dashboards, you know, from Stitcher and some of the other platforms, to not just look at how many downloads did we get, and I'm sure everybody's got an opinion on, you know, quantifying the worth of your show based on downloads. But, you know, not just looking at sort of the reach of your show, but also looking at, you know, are you holding on to people's attention? What is the time spent listening? Are there moments within your show where people are dropping off? Are there moments that suggest people are rewinding and re-listening or fast-forwarding through parts that they don't find interesting? Are there moments where you've been able to hold people's attention or not been able to hold people's attention? And so when I think about audience development, it's about show design. It is about the day-to-day production. It's about the distribution and marketing and promotion of your show. And, to tie it all together, it's about measuring all of those things and then feeding back into your production process, making sure that, you're actually listening to the behavior of the audience that you want to reach and making the show, ideally, better over time for that audience.
So I don't know about you, Laurie. I don't know whether he managed to convince me that I should be listening to branded podcasts, even though I understood, I can kind of understand the reasoning behind them. But I still have this sort of question of why brands in, the brands that he's talking about are getting into podcasting. It seems to me there's a sort of, they're trying to trade off this idea of authenticity, that loaded word.
Mm-hmm.
And create a sense that these commercial companies are interested in more than just the economic bottom line, and their brands are invested in the betterment of society in various kinds of ways. And in a sense, they're trying to build a network of trust that can have a secondary impact on their, on their products.
Yeah.
Let's say. Oh. I mean, did that ring true to you?
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly what they're trying to do. There's this notion of goodwill of a brand. And there's probably a more specific, branding and marketing term for that I'm not familiar with. But the idea of goodwill, where people feel a sense of goodwill when they think of your brand, and that's what they're trying to build here. And it's a very valuable thing for brands to have, but extremely difficult to measure. But I think what I've learned from Dan and from listening to some of the podcasts that they've produced is they are, first and foremost, it is about story. And that if you cannot engage someone in a story that doesn't overtly alert them to this is about a brand and we want you to, there's a call to action, i.e. we want your money somehow from this, I don't think they would take it on. They're all about story. And the folks that work for them all come from, story background, production backgrounds, et cetera. I think there's something there. If you can engage someone in listening to a long-term story, especially in this age of the attention economy, if you can engage someone in a story, even if you're not talking directly about your brand during that story at all, if it's just dropped in there at the end that it was brought to you by, that's really worth something to them. And I think it's worth something to the audiences too, or they wouldn't be there.
And I think it's another way of trying to get around the advertising, subscription, patron kinds of difficulties that podcasting has. I mean, difficulties is the wrong word, but It's anybody who tries to make a living up from the internet is always trying to figure out monetization. And, is it better to just know up front that this podcast has been produced by some financial company and not have to worry about ads? Or, I was listening to a podcast just the other day that had like three ads up front. And there was an interesting choice because, obviously with a lot of the podcast hosting sites that are connected to advertising models, both technologically and in terms of the way that they insert them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of podcasts, have one at the beginning, one in the middle somewhere, and maybe one at the end. And this podcast has chosen to do them all up front. But by the time 5 minutes were in, I couldn't even be bothered with it.
That's the danger of that, yeah.
You know what I mean? I didn't even get to the content because it was doing my head in. But I think the other thing that was interesting just out of that clip was this notion of what is audience development. And the processes that Dan is interested in having to match a show to an audience, but acknowledging that audiences are really fractured and it's a strategic process. His notion of branded podcasts are much more targeted in terms of trying to find the specific demographics, no matter how complicated they are, in order to match the content to that, which is very different, I would say, from like the way that I think about an audience as an academic podcaster who's very niche. And it's kind of like, oh, you know, I'm going to make my podcast in the way that I want to make it. And if the audience turns up, that's fine. Or at the very other end, you know, very, very broad commercial podcasts that want to get the biggest audience possible. It's a very specific understanding of what audience development is, I think. The other thing that Dan has done, which was one of those things where I thought, oh, God damn it, I wish I'd have done that, was to create the those podcast neighborhood visualizations, which were just really simple, elegant and effective ways of looking at how the listenership to certain types of genres or forms of podcasts are kind of correlated. I think it could have been really, or it can be really useful to have that knowledge of a neighborhood in terms of the aids or the help that you could get with audience building and collaboration, but also content development, being able to sort of identify how your work fits with other podcasts that you can see people are listening to of the same ilk, but then thinking about how to keep your sound unique.
He did fascinating work on that, just to map out where podcasts exist amongst podcasts, other podcasts that those listeners to the one podcast also listen to. And so that goes to what we were talking about earlier, the idea of finding better ways to identify what people might want to listen to beyond simply the content and the genre and the category. And Dan, I'd like to think of him as an honorary academic because he does a lot of this type of insightful. He mines a lot of data about podcasting and comes out with really amazing insights on the Pacific Content blog. I feel like I'm shilling for Pacific Content. I'm not, I swear. But yeah, but Dan really does some great work over there. And I find myself citing him in my writing a fair bit.
Wonderful. So that will just about do it for this episode. We thank you very much for taking the time out to listen. We hope you've enjoyed the clips. If you have, then please join us on the new season of the Podcast Studies podcast, where you'll hear another range of interviews. You'll hear discussion between myself and Laurie on a range of subjects that we've just touched upon today. And I hope you're going to come ready to engage with that. With those discussions, Laurie, I'm sure you are.
Oh yeah, am I ready? Yes. So hopefully we'll have some listeners from the Spoken Web podcast. You can find the Podcast Studies podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Spoken Web is a monthly podcast produced by the Spoken Web team as part of distributing the audio collected from and created using Canadian literary archival recordings found at universities across Canada. The episode of the Podcast Studies podcast that we shared with you today was produced by Dario Linares and Laurie Beckstead. Our podcast project manager and supervising producer is Judith Burr, and our podcast transcriptions are created by Kelly Cubbin. To find out more about Spoken Web, visit spokenweb.ca and subscribe to the Spoken Web podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may listen. If you love us, let us know. Rate us and leave a comment on Apple Podcasts or say hi on our social media at Spoken Web Canada. Stay tuned to your podcast feed for season 3 of the Spoken Web podcast coming to you on October 4th. The new season of the Podcast Studies podcast starts in mid-September. Check out podpage.com/podcast-studies-podcast for details.